Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing. I am very excited to introduce my guest today, Kathy O'Leary, who has over 35 years of gardening experience in the Rocky Mountains, the northern Idaho area, and recently spending some summers moved to Montana. So some new seasons there we could hear about. So welcome to the show, Kathy.
Thank you.
And go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, in 1978, my late husband and I moved onto 20 acres in the woods in North Idaho. And I was 21, so I had a lot of energy back then.
Nice.
And it was a very basic piece of ground. I started gardening the following spring and, you know, digging rocks out by hand and building a deer fence. And we had no electricity or running water, so we hauled water to the garden from a nearby creek. Over the years, you know, the garden got bigger. I planted fruit trees every year, many of them that I grafted. Then I got a small greenhouse, and I would sell plant starts at the local farmers market in the spring, and any other extra produce that I had. And I started growing garlic. I was really interested in growing garlic. And over the years, I got a bigger greenhouse, built a bigger greenhouse, and started growing more plant starts, and started growing more garlic varieties. And I quit going to the farmers market and just basically sold to friends and just some private clientele. I hauled the water from a creek and had a gravity feed system into the garden early in the spring. You know, I couldn't get down to the creek, so I would often melt snow to water my greenhouse plants. I would start up the greenhouse in early March. The last couple of years, I've been living in Trigo, Montana, and still have my place in Idaho, and I still grow my garlic back there, and have been experimenting with growing a few things that don't need any attendance. And my fruit trees, you know, have to make it on their own too. So it's kind of a big, big experiment, this whole gardening life of mine. Right now, I've really scaled down here in Montana to a cozy little 4x12-foot cold box and a few fruit trees. We're building a greenhouse. It should be operating in a couple of years just for personal fun.
Cool.
So that's a little bit of background about what I've been doing for the last 37 years.
Wow. Well, okay. That was a lot to share. And I had a couple of questions. What's the elevation in Idaho?
The elevation where I'm at over there is about 28. Here it's about 32.
So 2,800 feet.
It's a lot colder here. In fact, I think this might be the coldest spot in all of Trigo. The season here, I'm finding, is a bit more extreme. It's colder, hotter and drier in the summer, but short, and colder, much colder in the winter and the early spring.
Okay. Well, it is Trigo. People, I guess listeners, where I live is probably only 25 miles from where Kathy is by the crow flies, but we're at a little bit of a lower elevation. I think we're closer to 2,800 where I am. Uh-huh. And generally, like, even the town of Eureka has 3 weeks of a growing season on us, and then Trigo is probably way behind me, at least another 3 weeks from there. Right. So, and since it's a challenging where we are, it's even more challenging where you are. So, and, but so there's going to be tons of valuable, you know, tidbits and things to share with listeners. I know your story, and you're going to share a lot of information with us. I mean, selling starts and extra produce at the farmer's market and the garlic. I haven't really had anybody talk about garlic yet, so I'm sure people are excited about that. The hauling water. Now, I know that well. We lived for 6 years without running water here, and we didn't even have a creek, so we had to, like, either go to town or borrow from somebody. So it was just, I'll never do that ever again. If I ever live without water again, it's nice, got to be...
It's nice to have a faucet.
On the property. Yep. Yeah, I would even, I would haul it on the property, or, like, you know, if there was a creek, if it would have to be, I don't know, I can't see us moving at this point, but if you had to do it again. But the water is a big thing. Water and a propane fridge. Don't ever want to live without a fridge again. Okay, so Kathy, just quickly, like, where did you end up moving from Idaho from? Can I just ask that quick? Like, where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Washington State and in Central California. Central Coastal California, Santa Maria area. It's kind of between Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo, if anybody's familiar with that area. And then I moved up to the Sierras, and I lived there for a couple of years before I moved up to Idaho. I always wanted to live in the mountains and grow a garden. I mean, ever since I was a little kid, I always had that in my mind. Well, it was either that or become a street musician in San Francisco. So I decided to do the garden.
What instrument do you play now?
Oh, well, I don't play the violin, is pretty much is what I can say. I play a lot of instruments.
Oh, okay.
You know, tons, guitars, accordions, harps, ukuleles, a lot.
Cool. What was I gonna say? I always wanted to live in the mountains too. Like, my dream was to be, you know, Carolyn Ingalls in the mountains with the house, like the house on the prairie. So I got pretty close. Couldn't get much closer. And my house is bigger than hers.
Good. That's a plus.
Yeah. All right. So I usually start the show by asking people to tell us about their first gardening experience. Like, you know, how old were you? Were you a little kid? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Just, you know, really quickly, like, you know, where did you start?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard for me to recall because I just have always loved working with plants and gardening. I think probably my biggest first start was my grandmother. She always had a garden in Issaquah in Washington, and, you know, a vegetable garden. She grew food. My mother also loved plants, but she usually grew more flowers than vegetables and berries. And so that's my first gardening experience was taken along with my grandma, I would say.
Nice. Okay. And then just share with us really quickly, like, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
Well, you know, I think that what it means to me is nurturing the soil. I think that that's the most important part of organic gardening, or, you know, earth-friendly, is the health of the soil and nurturing that.
And who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques? Was it your grandmother? Or did you learn somewhere else? Or
well, you know, I think that I don't know who inspired me to grow organically. I'm not quite certain my grandmother really grew organically, but I just never. It was never a question to me that I would use chemicals or not use chemicals. It just seemed like it was very natural for me to want to grow things without the use of herbicides and pesticides. I don't know. I can't really say who or what inspired me. It was just something that I felt very moved personally to do.
And then how did you learn how to garden organically then?
Well, the first winter in Idaho, we moved on our piece of land in November, which is really a silly thing to do, but we did. I was young, you know, so it all worked out really fine. But that first winter, I just read so much. I read a lot of Rodale publications. Mm-hmm. You know, I checked books out of the library. I had a subscription to the Organic Gardening magazine. I just wrote a lot of notes about the things I read and kind of started a strategy for the following spring's garden. And around that same time, too, I met a woman that lived about 7 miles away, and she had been living in the area for quite some time. She wasn't a native, but she'd been living there for quite some time, and she shared with me a lot of information about the varieties that would grow well there, and just some of her experiences. So I learned a lot from her as well.
Cool. That's
and then, you know, my own slow process of years, the mistakes and the successes I had throughout the years, that is the most valuable experience that you can get, is just trying things out and learning from it.
Yep. I think that there's a lot of things that you just shared there. Like, you know, my listeners know that I talk a lot about, you know, going to the library. There's tons of resources at your library. And if you want to order a book, most libraries have interlibrary loan. Rodale's mm-hmm. Organic Gardening magazine is, you know, how I got interested in organic gardening. And then, you know, talking to a neighbor, like that's kind of my hopes of the podcast, is to, you know, share neighbors' stories and just, you know, bring people who are, you know, have grown their own small little gardens or started out, just to share that knowledge. And then, you know, hopefully when we get to like episode 300 or 500, there'll be quite a pile in different states. I'm getting spread out quite a ways. So, and today our Idaho, you know, something new there. So that'll be good. Mm-hmm. So tell us about something that grew well last season.
Well, last year I had the best crop of fruit on my trees that I ever did. And it just probably had a lot to do with the season. It certainly didn't have to do too much with what I was doing to glean such a wonderful crop. Also, some of my trees are, you know, 35 years old or older now, too. But I had just a huge, huge crop of apples and pears and plums. This is in my garden in Idaho. And I also had planted a few other things that I was not attending to. And I broadcast seeded some kale early in the spring, and whenever I was back in Idaho, I'd water it and pick it, and I just had tons and tons of kale, which is a fairly easy crop to grow. And, you know, and I also had a good garlic harvest. But last year, the very best thing to note was the fruit.
Okay, so when you were telling us about the fruit trees, you were saying that you grafted them. Do you want to tell us a little more about, you know, what that means and how you did that? How'd you learn how to do that? You know, anything you can share there?
Yeah. Well, for about 10 years, I would work at a tree nursery in Bonner's Ferry that we grafted seedlings, small tree seedlings. And so I learned how to graft, you know, and I got pretty good at it, I guess, if I did it for 10 years in 2-3 months during the winter. And so I decided that I would buy some rootstock, you know, which a lot of the fruit trees, most of the fruit trees will have a really hardy rootstock. It'll be a tree that is super hardy, but maybe doesn't have very good fruit on it. The hardiness is its main thing. And so you can do kind of basically a very simplistic way to tell you is you can do a slice. You slice off the small seedling up a few inches or 8 inches or so, and do another slice on a cutting off of a tree that has really good fruit, and then you wrap them together. You can wrap them together with electrical tape. That's what I did in the ground in Idaho. At the tree nursery, we would use grafting rubbers, which were like a flat rubber band that, you know, it wasn't a rubber band, you know, obviously, but it was flat like that, and you could just wrap it around the graft, and then somebody would put wax on it to keep air away from the two pieces. And so grafting in the field, you don't always have really good take because, you know, the elements, the cold, the air, the wet. But I had real good take on the apples that I grafted, and they've been producing really well for me now. Unfortunately, I can't remember the varieties that I put on them. I think I have some notes somewhere of what the varieties were. But that's the purpose of grafting, is that you can have a hardy rootstock that will live through these cold northern winters, but then you can have a good variety on it. I have on some of my apples over there are Macintosh, which I really like. They're a nice fall apple. And then I have a couple of yellow transparents, which are very early summer apple. They don't keep very well. And then I have several other varieties that I can't remember what they are. But anyway, that's how I learned to graft and just kind of experimented with it. And most of the things I experimented with did take.
Wow. Nice. Well, I've never really seen anybody graft anything like that, but that sounds awesome. And I like the way that you've, taken a hardy stock and mixed it with something that produces well. So that's neat. Well, who would have thought? I guess I did have one guest, Russ, who talked about fruit trees and grafting. And actually, he was talking about this weird thing where they were putting like plums and peaches together on the same tree. But he said didn't work too well.
A lot of people like to do several different apple varieties on one tree. And there is the idea that you can graft like plums. Let's see. What were you saying?
Like plums and peaches or something, or maybe plums and nectarines, or I don't, you know, fruits that probably were like close.
The stone fruits may or may not be able to be compatible to grafting like that. Of course, you couldn't do something like a plum on an apple, you know. It has to be at least slightly related to it, so... Yeah, and I haven't played around with that. It just seems to me that when I'm picking a tree, I just want to pick it. I don't want to know that one branch is going to be ready, but then the next branch won't be ready till later or whatever. So I like to just go ahead and do it all at once if possible. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about something you want to try new this year or something different or that you're excited about?
Well, here in Trigo, where I have running water and electricity, we try to do an automatic sprinkler, kind of a drip sprinkler system on the cold box last year, because I'm kind of traveling around a little bit now. You know, I was so... stationary for 35 years doing my farming, and I kind of have an opportunity to do a few other things, pursue my music a little more, and do a little bit of traveling. So and the auto sprinkler system, which did not work well last year, is what I intend to try new this year to see if we can sort out the problems with that system. So that's my big new thing I want to try this year is to work the kinks out of that.
Okay, I can totally relate to that. As I looked, as Mike's like, he dug us a big, huge, giant air. We put a deep well in the year before last. Oh. And last year was the first year we had water. So he is just going to town this year and just has planted the biggest garden. I call it like his miniature farm. And I'm just looking at it going, okay, we're never going anywhere for till
well,
the
that's
fall.
It. It is a big commitment, and I enjoyed it. I mean, it did get a little consuming, and it's very hard work. Mm-hmm. And but that's what I did from March till the middle, towards the end of October. That's what I did. Was yeah. I dedicated that, and I could never, hardly ever wait for winter. People would say, oh, no, winter's coming. And I'd say, I can't wait, because then I had my time off.
Yeah, and, he loves know, it. He's happy as a clam.
The watering. Mm-hmm. The watering is, you know, I did a lot of different, tried a lot of different things in, with my gravity system in Idaho. And the thing that worked out the best for me, which was not efficient for time, but it worked the best for me, and that was handheld watering. I could make sure the water was going right where I wanted it, and I paid very close attention to what needed water and what didn't need water. And I really didn't use sprinklers. I tried some drip irrigation, but because we were hauling out of a creek, it would just get clogged up, and I'd try the filter, and the filter was constantly getting clogged up. And I just tried a lot of different things and just kept coming back to standing there with the hose. And, you know, it was a lot of time spent, but it was not a bad way to start the morning.
Mm-hmm. I know it well.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of that here. So we're just, you know, we are tickled to have a well and be able to run a sprinkler for the first time, have the grandkids come right. Run under the sprinkler besides, but to
that
water the
garden.
Exciting. So I think our whole weed thing is going to change. We're finally going to have real weeds. Because did you find that, like, when you water like that, you get less weeds that way because you're just really focusing your water right on the base of the plants? I think it's that way here.
Yeah.
Anyway. So,
right.
There's certainly a certain thing to be said for water, but it definitely is time consuming when you have to, and then I think it also, you know, limits how big you can grow. As I said, I can see Mike is expanding. Like, there's more seeds in the ground than I've ever seen already, I think. So,
right.
We'll see.
It does limit the size. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His goal has always been to grow all our vegetables for the year so we don't have to buy produce, mm-hmm. or at least as much of it as we can. So I think he's going to come really, really close this year. Mm-hmm. All right, Kathy, tell us about something that didn't work so well last season.
Well, that automatic sprinkler system that we're going to try to sort out this year. So, you know, and I don't know if you are looking for a plant, a crop that didn't work well or what, but this is the thing that didn't work so well for me last year, was just trying to get that automatic water thing together.
Sure. No, I think that's a perfect answer. And it's, you know, something that a lot of people, I'm sure, can relate to. And I'm sure a lot of listeners have different water situations. So, I can totally relate, and I'm sure other people can too. That's a perfect answer. How about something that you find is easy to grow and is generally successful every time?
Well, the early spring greens, like as soon as the ground can be worked and you can plant things like mustard and arugula and lettuce and peas and radishes, and you know, a lot of times I'll plant that, and I like to use the row cover Agrabond or Rime is a brand name, and it's really nice. You can plant things as super early as you can. You can put the row cover over it, and then they'll germinate faster. They'll come up. You'll be able to start thinning and eating greens really, really quickly in the spring. If you wait too long, the problem with the early greens is that when the weather turns hot, they'll bolt and go to seed. And so it's nice to get them in as very early as possible. But for me, that's been a super easy thing every year to do, pretty much problem-free.
Okay, I got a couple of questions really quick. What were the names of the row covers?
Agrabond.
Agrabond.
Yeah, that's what I've been buying lately. When I first started buying this type of row cover, it went by the name of Rime.
Like R-E-L-A-Y?
R-E-E-M-A-Y.
Oh, okay.
Rime.
Okay.
And like Johnny's seeds out of Maine, a lot of the seed catalogs would sell this. I had a friend who was a market gardener over in Moyer Springs, and she often would buy big rolls of this, and I could buy a certain amount of feet off of her huge roll from her. So that was really nice to have that source of it. It's kind of, I don't know what the fabric is. I want to say it's sort of like a spun polypropylene or something. And it allows moisture to go through and air. And it protects to maybe about 5 degrees. So it's really, Ooh. Really handy in the early part of the season and the late part of the season. And because it allows moisture and air, you know, it's much better than plastic. You know, people used to use plastic a lot. But this fabric is really wonderful. You have to tack it down with, you know, maybe hold it down with rocks. You can make little hoops out of PVC or heavy wire and put the Agrabond over the hoops. And, you know, I've actually grown peppers like that for a major part of the season. That was one of the crops I used to grow in Idaho just because a lot of people couldn't grow any, you know, it's not an pepper growing place, you know, but I really loved hot peppers. So I would grow tons of hot peppers and I would protect them for at least half the season or more with this row cover.
Excellent. Okay, cool. I'm glad you shared that with us. Okay. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Well, in this northern climate, anything that requires a long season with warm nights, like watermelons or okra, things like that, it's like, you know, if you want to play around with that, that's okay, but don't count on having a crop, especially something like okra that needs warm nights. And the way you find these things out is reading the seed packets or, again, talking to local gardeners and just finding out information about it. If you've got a crop you really, you know, a vegetable you really love, you know, maybe you should find out first if it's really feasible to grow in your area. And don't plant the tender plants too soon, like, you know, tomatoes. A lot of people, when it starts getting warm, they get real excited and run out and plant all of these things that 2 weeks later freeze and die. So, I would just say to steer away from things in this area, for the listeners in the north, steer away from things that really require super long season and warm nights.
Absolutely. That's great advice. And that certainly happened to me, where I got very excited and planted a bunch of things. And sometimes you can cover them, and sometimes you just lose it and got to start all over. And
And if they, you know, if they make it through some really cold and extreme conditions, a lot of times they'll just be stunted and not happy. And later, if you try to plant later, then those things will take off and surpass the ones you've gotten in early. So, you know, stay calm in the spring when it comes to things like tomatoes and cucumbers and things like that. And in this area and in the Idaho area, I would say, North Idaho, I would say, you know, wait until the very end of May or beginning of June to set some of those things out.
Certainly. Oh, super advice. Thanks, Karathy. Now, tell us, which activity, do you have like an activity that's your least favorite activity to do in the garden, like something you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
Pulling quack grass, mm-hmm. I would have to say, because it's very hard. It has these rhizomes that just go on. And if you leave a little tiny piece of that root in the ground, it grows, and every year it's there, and it's trying to march into the garden, and you have to dig the edges out. And one year I was so determined to find something useful with this tenacious weed, and I had some really long rhizomes, and I actually kind of used them to on my bean trellis like string. And, you know, they dried out, and they didn't cause any trouble that way. But that's probably my least favorite. Also, when I did have the really big garden in Idaho, the fall cleanup after the frost, it was, you know, it was a necessary thing. I wouldn't say it was one of my favorite things to do, especially after the frost, because things would start getting slimy, and you'd just have to, you know, pull up the stuff, clean up the garden. I used to just wait and wait for snow so I could quit working. So that was another thing I didn't like. Here in Trigo, with my smaller situation and just learning what the problems are here, I'd say the things that are the most difficult that I don't like so well is trying to keep the Canada thistle back and trying to protect anything at all from everything from the ground squirrels. So there's, you know, a lot of them here.
Cool. Okay. All right. Well, how about your favorite activity to do in the garden?
Well, I think, it was setting in transplants. So, you know, I would do the grow my own starts, like I was saying earlier, and harden them off, which means bringing them in and out of the greenhouse, getting them ready to go outside. And then when the time was right and the plants were ready, I loved setting them out into the garden, just planting them into the garden. I'd have this whole area that was bare, and then at the end of the day, it was like it wasn't really instant, but there was this garden, all of these little plants set in their little places. So I think that was probably my favorite activity, was setting in the transplants.
Nice. Oh, that sounds beautiful. I can picture that. Absolutely. Okay, tell us about the best crop you ever grew.
Well, last year's fruit harvest was very, very, the very best. But as far as crops that aren't, you know, perennial trees happening, there was a couple of different things. And one of my varieties of garlic, it's called Northern White, and it's a huge bulb, four cloves to the bulb. And they're just beautiful and huge. That's probably my nicest crop that I've ever grown, but it's very consistent. Every year it's a nice crop of that. There is also a hot pepper that is super prolific, and it was called Louisiana Hot. I haven't seen it for a long time. They also called it Arledge Hot, and it's just very, very prolific, just tons of these hot peppers, about the size of a jalapeno or bigger, you know, just beautiful, compact plants loaded with peppers. So I guess those kind of are the best crops I've grown.
Cool. I'm kind of excited to get to the recipe part, see if you share any hot pepper recipes or anything good. How about the best gardening advice you ever received?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to recall. Somewhere along the line, I think I got the notion of succession planting, which I think is really, really useful in these shorter growing areas. And it's not like, it's really not companion planting, but it's planting something like, say, radishes that are going to grow fast and get out of there, get out of the ground. You could make a little row of radishes and then plant something else that's going to take a little longer and that might be there like the whole season. You could plant green beans or something, or you could plant kale even, you know, next to these radishes. Just something that you could do kind of like the succession where the early stuff would be out of the ground before it crowds the next crop that's coming. And I grew a lot in wide beds, not single rows. So in wide beds, that's something that's very easy to do. Also, though, there was another thing that I did get a little tidbit from a Mennonite gardener in the area in out of Bonner's Ferry that has to do with tomatoes. And, you know, in this area, it's kind of a challenge to get ripe tomatoes off the vine. Mm-hmm. In early August, to stop watering them, start holding off the water, and it forces the tomatoes to ripen their crop. And when I started doing that, I've been growing tomatoes for years and years and years, and would get the most of the ripening would be in my house after the freeze. I would pick green tomatoes before the freeze, and tomatoes that were just starting to turn, and bring them in and put them in boxes in the house, and they would ripen in the house. But you can actually get them to start ripening faster if you begin to hold the water off at the beginning of August.
Okay. Well, that could be the best tip anybody's given on the podcast ever. but, like, stop watering altogether or just cut back a little?
Well, I usually would cut back a little, and then by mid-August, pretty much stop. I mean, if I gave them a dribble, I'd give them a dribble, but pretty much stop. And then, yeah, then that they would ripen up a lot better.
Wow, that sounds cool. All right, how about, so this is kind of a new question. I haven't really asked a lot of people this. Have you ever entered a fair?
Well, no, I haven't. I okay. guess I was too busy all the time at home.
Okay. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like if you moved and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Well, I have this tool and it's more sentimental. It's practical, but it's very, very sentimental. Mm-hmm. And it was like a little, what do you call it? It's not a cultivator. It's a three-prong little kind of rakey sort of thing. That was my grandmother's, but I used to call it my grandmother's claw, because it looks like a three-fingered claw, and I love that. Like I said, it was more sentimental than practical, I suppose. But I'd always freak out if I left it somewhere in the garden and couldn't find it. You know, it had an old wooden handle on it, and it's just been used forever and ever. So that's my favorite too, is my grandmother's claw.
I like that. And those are handy. That's one of my favorite tools too. I know what you're talking about. Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
How about eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Because that's always a tough one for me. It just seems like I'm always busy and doing things, and it comes on a lot at the same time.
Yeah. Well, everything, of course, is a little different in the requirements for when they are ready to harvest. Okay, so if you say you've got apples, apple trees, and they start falling on the ground, well, then that's kind of an indication that they're probably ready. And you can, if you're super busy, you can kind of let some of them fall, and then you can use the downfalls for applesauce and things like that. But if you're wanting to pick at the time, you know, when you start seeing apples and start to fall, just what I do is I hold on to an apple and kind of bend it back on itself, on the stem. And if it comes off easily, then it's ready. And same with pears. Also, you could cut them in half, and if the seeds are brown, then it's ready. If you cut it in half and the seeds are not brown yet, it isn't ready. Let's see, what else? You know, there's a gazillion things. All the requirements are kind of different. Apples, like the yellow transparent apples, are very susceptible to going bad fast. So if they're on the ground and they've been on the ground for a couple of days, they're going to start rotting right away. And so those always are very good for making applesauce out of, you know, not the ones that are rotten, of course, but, you know, the yellow transparent apples are real good for pies and applesauce. I don't know. I guess that's probably what I would say, and just kind of stick with the fruit thing for the harvesting, yeah.
Okay, that's perfect. Those are new tips that I haven't heard yet either. How about secrets for preserving food, like making it last? Do you do any canning or freezing or anything?
Yeah. Well, I have done a lot of canning and freezing and pickling and storage. Basically, when you're going to can and pickle, I think that one of the best things to do is to pick them when they're ripe and put them up right away. You know, don't pick your cucumbers one day and make pickles 2 days later. You know, your product will be so much better if you just pick them and put them up right away. And as far as storage goes, I guess also I wanted to talk just a little bit about garlic, and this could have even been about the harvesting thing.
That's
too.
Okay. This is perfect. Sure.
Yeah. The garlic, usually garlic is planted in the fall before the ground freezes. You can plant it in the spring. You won't get as big of bulbs, and you'll have a later harvest. Planting in the fall has advantages because it gets an early start in the spring, and it ripens. I mean, it's ready to harvest mid-July to late July, and then you need to cure it, and you need to have some dry weather to cure. So if you've got, you know, a spring-planted crop and you're not harvesting until September, you're not going to have really good curing weather then. So the garlic, which people don't understand this sometimes people will want to just let the garlic plant dry out and fall over. And the problem with that is that the leaves that you see that are on the garlic, on the plants, they represent the bulb wrappers. So if you have all dead leaves, all the bulb wrappers pretty much are going to be gone off of that bulb. And you need to have the bulb wrappers for so that it'll store properly. You know, it'll last longer in its storage. So each green leaf represents a bulb wrapper that is still intact on the garlic. So it's good to harvest it when it has about 4 or 5 green leaves left. You know, new people to this will want to maybe just pull one or dig around and make sure it's formed into the bulb nicely. And you want to wait until there's 2 or 3 dead leaves down at the base of the garlic, and then, like I said, 4 or 5 green leaves still. You don't want to water it after July if it's been planted in the fall. You know, then you'll get about a mid-July harvest out of it. Of course, if it rains, there's nothing you can do about that. But I never water my garlic crop. And I have really, really nice garlic. The winter snow, you know, does a lot when it melts. And, you know, it's one of my nicest crops that don't need me there all the time staring at it, which is why I'm still growing my garlic in Idaho and I'm 3 hours away from it. When you pull it, then you'll want to lay it on screens or hang it in bundles of maybe 8 or 10 in a shaded, ventilated area outside, and don't expose it to the sun. One time I had a friend call and say, all of my bulbs are translucent. I have it curing on these racks with tin over the top. And it was like 90 degrees outside. Mm-hmm. And the tin, the sun hitting that tin, just heated those guys up, and they just got fried. So no exposure to the sun. It'll take a couple of weeks to cure it, according to the weather. And then you can clip it off of the stalks and brush the dirt off, clip the roots back. The roots actually will absorb more moisture than the leaves will during curing. And sometimes if we run into some really wet weather, I've gone out and started clipping the roots off of the cured, you know, the curing garlic, just to keep the moisture from being sucked back into the garlic. So I thought maybe I could talk about onions and potatoes a little quickly too.
The onions, you're just full of information. I see why so many people are like, you have to talk to Kathy O'Leary. You have to talk to Kathy O'Leary. Yes, go ahead.
I've had a lot of years of experience. When you're growing onions, you know, it's the same thing. They're gonna be ready later than the garlic, like in the end of August or so, or maybe mid-August. But you're gonna want to quit watering them beginning of August or so. And when some of them start to fall over, then knock the rest of them over and let them just sit like that out in the garden with their tops knocked over for a little bit, like a couple of days, say. And then you can pull them. And then I don't hang them. I put them on racks in a well-ventilated, shaded area like you would for the garlic. And don't clip them back. Make sure you don't clip the tops of them off until they're completely dry. Because if you clip the tops back before they're dry, that can let rot come into the onion during storage. So you want to make sure the tops, you know, everything is completely dry before you clean them up, before you cut them. The potatoes, the vines, this is different than the onions and garlic. The vines have to be completely dead. So after the vines are completely dead, dig up the potatoes and let them dry in the sun for a couple of hours and turn them over and, you know, let them dry. That kind of gives them a little, hardens them a little bit. But you have to watch out that it's not super hot. You know, one time I left them out doing that for a couple of hours, but it was 90 degrees. And they did not keep. They were going bad before I could even get them into the storage. So if it's, you know, in the 70s, that's okay. But if it starts getting up to the 80s, you're going to want to hold off curing them out in the sun like that. And just make sure you only keep them in the sun for a couple of hours. Wait, I had one more thing I wanted to talk about, and that is carrots. And what I like to do to keep carrots, and I grow them in a wide bed, which is much more efficient for space. In the fall, before it freezes, mulch them at least a foot deep with some straw or leaves. I like to use some nice dry straw. And then you might want to put some plastic over the top of it, and then drive a stake into the front of your row, because when it snows, you'll know where it is. And if you don't have trouble with gophers or ground squirrels, you can leave them in the ground all winter, and you can dig them. The ground won't freeze if you've got them mulched at least a foot deep. You can dig through the snow and dig carrots. I used to dig about 2 weeks' worth of carrots at a time. And, you know, that way they would keep nice and fresh. And they're just so sweet and delicious when they've gotten cold over the winter like that. So that's an easy way to store the carrots if you don't have the gopher problem.
But what about if the ground's frozen? Don't they freeze? Not if you have that
mulch
on top?
Well, if you've got that nice layer of mulch, it won't. The edges might. You know, now, granted, the last couple winters, we've had some really extremely cold weather here, a lot colder than we've had for 30 years. I wasn't back in my Idaho garden when I did get back there. I didn't, this last two winters, I didn't dig carrots, but all of the other previous winters, I have done that. So if you've got, I don't know, if you get a super 35 degree below, then maybe you won't be able to do that. But if you've got a good, at least foot thick of mulch, and the reason I like to put plastic over the mulch is that then the mulch isn't wet and gooey, oogie, you know, when you go to dig. It's still nice and dry, and it's much nicer to pull that back than the slimy, wet mulch. But, you know, the ground all around can be frozen, and the middle of the carrot bed, you know, is fine. So it's definitely worth a try. Mm-hmm. If the ground does freeze, if you don't have thick enough mulch, it's not going to hurt the carrots, and you can dig them in the spring. You may lose, you know, a few to some rot, but you'll be able to dig them in the spring, and they'll be really, really good.
Now, can you tell me, what's a wide bed? Like, what exactly do you mean by a wide bed? Just...
Well, instead
by size?
Of the
old-fashioned like raised beds,
no, it's just instead of the old-fashioned like one row of carrots all the way down your garden, or one row of lettuce, I would take about a 3 foot wide area, something that's easy for me to reach from both ends. So it could be 2 to 3 feet. And then I plant in that. And for the carrots, instead of doing long rows of carrots in those wide beds all the way down the length of the garden, I do short rows of carrots across the width. So you've got all these little short rows of carrots.
Okay.
And, you know, it's... It's just a much more efficient use of space. You don't have these paths between each one little row of vegetables. And, you know, it's like it's more efficient for the space and everything. I don't know. I always did it that way, and it worked out really well.
I understand what you're saying now. I like that. Mm-hmm. I'll have to try that. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Anything else? I mean, that was a lot.
I don't want to cut you off. I can't think of it right now.
I feel like I got a whole book here. This is awesome. Okay. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
Well, I made up this favorite recipe one year when I had a lot of patty pan squashes. Do you know what they are?
Mm-mm.
They're like scallop. They're kind of like these little scallop squashes. Mm-hmm. And they're also called patty pans. And so I would pick them when they, you know, weren't really huge. I'd cut them in half. I'd make grilled patty pan pizzas. So I'd cut these patty pan squashes in half and rub some olive oil on them and put some of my homemade pesto on them and sliced cherry tomatoes and garlic and some freshly shredded Parmesan cheese and some sesame seed. And then I put them on the barbecue. And I lived off of them for weeks one summer. They were so good, I just didn't want to eat anything else but that. So I guess that was my favorite recipe from the garden. Grilled patty pans pizzas.
That sounds delicious. That sounds so good. All right. Well, just really quick, back to the weird or unusual foods. Like, even though garlic's not a weird or unusual food, anything you did with that was special or unique or anything?
Well, I would also put that on the grill. Just the
Grilled garlic.
Roasted garlic. Put a bulb on the grill, roast it, and when I grew corn, then you can smear that roasted garlic on the roasted corn. It was really good. But, I'd like to do a lot of grilling on the barbecue towards the end of the season and grill my peppers and sometimes I would make, when I was a kid, we used to call it pocket stew. And we would take it camping. So you'd cut up onions and potatoes and whatever else you want, peppers, garlic, a few green beans, put them in foil, pour a little olive oil on them and wrap them all up in foil and, either stick them in the fire pit, the coals, or put them, on the barbecue, and then you'd have like these nice steamed vegetables. Something like that would be really easy to prepare and then take camping with you.
Nice. I like that idea a lot. Okay. How about a favorite internet resource? Do you ever...
Well, I am actually kind of a novice to the internet since I didn't have internet in Idaho and I sometimes have internet here. And I just had discovered that I can Google things and found out about Wikipedia. And so I don't know. I don't have a favorite internet resource, but because I'm a novice, but there is a lot out there. I started looking up information about the Canada thistle, and got very dismayed to find that it can grow 20 feet deep into the ground and 17 feet laterally, and the seeds can live for 20 years. And, so there's all kinds of wonderful and frightening information out there.
Okay. Oh, yep. There's a ton on the internet. You'd be surprised. Yeah, one thing I talk to a lot of guests about is Twitter. Gardeners are all over Twitter. And then the other place is YouTube. There's lots of great information on YouTube. But certainly sorting through it and knowing, what's good and what's not is kind of tricky. So, got to say, I love the internet, though. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or anything like that you love? to share?
Well, yeah, I've got a couple books that I really like. I don't have an absolute favorite, but for garlic, the very best book is Ron Engelman's Growing Great Garlic. And I, even though I've been growing garlic for years and years and years, I still refer to that every year. And it's written in a, it's very easy to read. There is another book too that I enjoy, by Susan Weed. And she's kind of a delightful author. And, it's called Healing Wise. And I really like that too. Okay. So there's a couple there that I,
perfect. Well, thanks for sharing those. And the links to those will all be in the show notes if listeners want to, you know, look those books up. Okay. How about, like, any advice for people who maybe wanted to try growing starch or do anything with some extra produce or anything? Or you were saying that you ended up with just, you know, like, private clients for your garlic. Do you have any advice for how to get started that way?
Well, I probably don't have a lot of practical advice because it's a very, very time-consuming situation. And whenever I did any of that type of work, I didn't do it to make money, you know, which is good because there wasn't enough for me to survive on. But as something that I just super enjoyed doing, you know, I just have always followed my heart and my inclinations rather than being very practical. I don't know. If my advice, I guess, would be if somebody is interested in and making a little extra money off of either starts or produce, is check out your local farmers market first, see what the people are doing there, and see if there's maybe a niche that you may be able to fit into there, and kind of take it from there. I am glad I did the market when I did. I think I probably did it for 10 or 15 years. But it grew tiresome for me, and I did enjoy having my own clientele. And so, you know, that's kind of how you can build that up, is through the farmers market. I'm sure there's a lot of other ways to do it, too. That's just how I did it for myself.
Well, that's tons of great advice. And I think one of the most important things is to talk about how time consuming it is and that it's not probably yeah. the most profitable way to grow unless you're really committed or going to go on a bigger scale.
Right.
And, right. And you know, and it would just have to be something you really love to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. You know, when I had all of that time involved with the starts and with my garden, I just was doing it for myself also, but, you know, then I would do a gazillion times more than I needed, you know, for the plant starts. I did quit growing produce for sale because I thought, you know, I'm hauling water. This is just totally ridiculous for me to grow somebody else's vegetables. But I would do the garlic since I never had to water it and it worked out very, very well for me. It does take a very fertile soil, but, yeah, it's like if you're going to go into a commercial greenhouse situation or a commercial farm, then perhaps you've gone to school for that and perhaps you've had experience with that prior to starting your own business and you know what you're getting into. Otherwise, I'd say poke around, have fun with what you want to do, and if you want to do a little extra, a good place to start would be through the farmers market.
Well, I just think that's lots of valuable advice and good for listeners to hear and just different little tidbits. So, and very practical, very humble. Thanks for sharing that, Kathy. Okay, final question. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either in your local area or a national or global scale?
That's pretty tough.
I know. It's a big one.
But I think the most crucial issue facing the planet is hard to pinpoint, but overpopulation certainly is one, which also leads to pollution, which, you know, an overpopulation and aggression, you know, and wars, those are really crucial issues facing the planet. A change for a greener world, you know, I'm not very educated on the different charities, but for something for one person to do is to grow your own food, and or buy locally, you know, then if you can buy things locally, it's good because it's keeping from having to transport stuff from way far away, you know, it keeps things closer, you know, grow your own, buy locally. So
perfect. Yeah. I like that part. The transportation issue, I think, is just crucial, and people in America just don't even blink about it or realize how much that impacts the industry and the food that you eat. And you need to think about that in your carbon footprint, like where your food's coming from. Like,
right.
You know, having watermelons in Montana in the winter to me just seems absurd. But I know they're in our schools. The kids get them for snacks and things like that.
In the winter?
Oh, yeah. Watermelon and what other crazy things? I don't know. You just pineapple in little plastic bags, you know, these sticky sticks of pineapple and just some obscure foods, which, you know, it's good that they have the healthy nutrition snack program, but I'd like to see it be just a little more sustainable.
And I think that there's something to be said about eating things in season,
right?
You know, and like in your area that's in season.
And I think substituting different things, like, you know, if something doesn't grow well in your area, there's usually something else you can substitute for it that's kind of got a similar flavor or something different. And then, like you were saying, that, you know, it's fun when things come on to taste them and you get excited about it when it's ready in its season. Okay, just lastly, do you have an inspirational tip or a quote to help motivate listeners to reach into that dirt and start their own garden?
Well, this is my personal quote.
Perfect.
And it's all mulch in the end. So you can figure out what that means to you, I guess.
I love it. Kathy, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to me today. I know we ended up going a little long, but you had so much to share. I know listeners are going to get a ton out of this conversation. If they want to go look at the show notes, like I said, it's its own little book full of just practical gardening knowledge, you know, that can be applied anywhere, even though we're in a northern area. I think a lot of this information is applicable, you know, anywhere in the United States. So thank you so much for sharing today.
My pleasure, and happy spring.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com, like awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. If you like what you've heard today, we'd love it if you'd head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. It really helps us get found by other listeners and share the knowledge. Thank you again for listening. Have a great day.